the laws of physics work just as well as they ever did. So we can still build things. We just have to get off our ass and do it. You know, the future in science fiction terms doesn't just sort of like happen. You know, your flying car doesn't happen along because it's 2024 or whatever. Somebody has to do the work. Somebody has to actually build it. And so I wanted to write, okay, what happens? What happens? What does the future look like if we build stuff again?
Devin, welcome to the show. This is really exciting. This is a little bit of a deviation from the typical thing I cover on the show, but just in the sense that you are not someone directly in Bitcoin building, but I love to expand on the kind of philosophy and the ideas of liberty in general, because I mean, that's at the heart of why Bitcoin exists, is how do you establish security and property for the individual so that society can exist, because it's a prerequisite. And yeah. You had a phenomenal thread with the, I can't even remember the name now, of the interim CEO or the current CEO of OpenAI.
Yes.
And
yes.
And mostly I actually came across it on the AI list of things that I follow before I did on the Bitcoin side, but it got shared around there too. And it was a phenomenal thread about the idea. It's such a good distinction because it's one of those things that is so complicated, so difficult to articulate sometimes what the difference is. But I loved the distinction of wise people don't disagree on societal design. They disagree with societal design. And as soon as I read that, I was like, I should probably get Devin on the show.
And, well, thank you for having me.
Yes, absolutely. So because I also don't know a whole lot about you, I've slowly kind of like gone that way. And I've got your book now, which I am very much enjoying. And I'm pretty picky about that sort of stuff, by the way. Why don't you give an introduction for yourself and for the audience who probably doesn't know you since you're not in the Bitcoin circles, really?
Well, I spent a couple of decades as a software engineer after spending a youth curled up in the back of a library with a massive stack of classic science fiction. And after I retired from engineering, I decided, hey, you know, I can do anything I want with the rest of my life, and I would like to build something where I don't need somebody's permission. So I went back to the science fiction I loved in my youth, and I said, okay, let's construct some visions of the future. Let's tell some stories, and let's talk about what the future might look like. Because that was really one of the defining characteristics of science fiction in the late 20th century, and really something that I think people often underestimate, the importance of science fiction. You know, one question I like to ask is, you know, think about all of the things that were invented in the 20th century. Now, name one that was not first anticipated in science fiction. It's a bit of a head scratcher, right?
Yeah, I don't know.
Yeah.
That would be a deep.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, maybe task. You could find something, but you'd have to do some serious looking.
Yeah.
And what that means is, you know, maybe science fiction inspired design, maybe it anticipated design, maybe some of both. But what science fiction allows us to do is think about the future and make values decisions about it before that technology actually arrives. Mm-hmm. And I think that's an important kind of conversation to be having. And it will become more and more important as technology advances faster and faster in this sort of synergistic mode that it does. And we need to be thinking about, okay, these are the things that we can do. What do we want to do? And why is that important to us? So that seemed to me like a very worthwhile thing to be doing.
Yeah. Yeah, for sure. No, that's a really interesting.
So I sat down and I wrote a story, which my agent is waving at me off camera to get me to hold up. So I will be holding this up periodically to appease her.
It's right there. I can see it. I can see it in the background right there.
Yes. Yes.
Now I'm curious about, so you wrote Theft of Fire. This is your sci-fi thing. Yes. When did this even release? So I just picked it up when, right after the thread, people were talking about it. And I was like, oh, I'll check out another book.
Yeah. Yeah. We had one day where we were on top of science fiction in Amazon, like number three or something.
Wow. And, wow. That's awesome.
In the top 1,000 on all of Amazon, which is like all books everywhere. So that was a big day for us. But this released November 11th.
Okay. So it's really new.
Oh, yes. This whole thing is new for me. This is my life now. And I'm just getting used to this.
Nice. Well, I'm glad I got you before you're really hard to get a hold of for podcasts then.
Well, I will try not to ever let that happen, but we shall see.
Out of curiosity, just on the book, since it's fresh in mind, I was reading it last night.
Yes.
And I will say too, as someone, like one of the things, I'm not sure if you looked into Bitcoin Audible at all, but
to some of your stuff.
Okay, cool. But the main format of the show is that I read articles. So I am an avid reader and have been for a really long time. And one of the things that I would always do with my wife is we'd read fantasy novels. Like one of my favorites is The Name of the Wind and that whole series. Yes. I would read and act it out. So I've done narration for a lot of books, but I have yet to do one that's like a fantasy, a sci-fi, like a novel. Like it's all been nonfiction.
Yeah.
But on this book in particular, is this intended to be as a series? I don't think I'm long enough in it to know whether something else is being set up.
Was for 3 books.
Okay, good.
As I am working on the second one, it is now 4 because number 2 has turned into number 2 and 3. I realized I just had a certain amount of material where it wasn't going to fit in one more book. And, you know, the first book is pretty hefty. It's 154,000 words. And the rest of them look to be equally lengthy. So there's a lot of material to cover. But, you know, there's a lot of distance to go because the series, not to spoil anything more than the very, very general, goes from petty criminal gets blackmailed to technological singularity in the fate of the galaxy. So we've got some ground to cover.
There's a lot of movement there. Yeah, yes. Definitely. Cool. Well, I am definitely going to stay on this one then. I haven't sat down and actually physically read a book in a long time, and I don't think I realized
that. Yeah, I have a lot of people telling me that, and I think I understand.
Yeah.
I think that a lot of institutions of our society have been sort of institutionally captured by a certain type of person. And I think we all know what I'm talking about, where they start sort of ceasing to serve the ends of that institution and start to try to loot the institution or steer it toward their own agenda. And I think publishing,
their means are the ends, what they want.
Publishing has been one of these. Mm-hmm. And so we've spent a couple of decades with really a lot of people who were very, very enthusiastic readers having nothing to read. Like there's all these books out there and I have nothing to read because, you know, every time I pick up a book by one of these imprints that used to be great science fiction publishers, it's basically communist agitprop.
Yeah.
You know, you can have your prevalent science fiction.
It's like Hollywood. It just, I can't even go to the movies anymore.
All of your galactic empires are just static backdrops for people sitting around having discussions of pronouns over tea. And then there's an alternative to that, but that's the sort of indie publishing world that has a lot of good stuff in it, but there's no gatekeepers.
Mm-hmm.
And TradPub as a gatekeeper used to provide a valuable service in the sense that they kept people out of publishing and writing who really had no business being there because
curation.
Yeah. So now people are caught between this communist agitprop and indie shovelware, and they just don't have the expectation anymore that when they pick up a book, they're going to have a good experience. So the desire to read something that makes us feel something is burning as bright as ever, but some of the hope has gone away, and people are covered in this protective armor of cynicism. And it's been very difficult sometimes as a new author to punch through that cynicism. But when I do, it's like, I don't read anymore and I like this. And wow, that's a nice feeling.
Yeah, that's good. That's good. You know, I actually, it's funny, I have a film background. I went to school for film and went out to LA for a short while before I realized the culture was just not really for me.
Yeah.
But story has always been my first love. In fact, it wasn't until Bitcoin kind of just took over my time and fascination. And one of the things I say is that what fascinates me most, the reason that I am like locked into Bitcoin is because of the story.
Yeah.
Like the story that Bitcoin tells about society. And what our future might be like.
Yeah.
And so I'm curious, specifically taking Theft of Fire, since this is your first book here.
Yeah.
How in a broader sense, how does philosophy entertain or inform like science fiction history, and then kind of where it's degraded today? And then also, how does it inform what you write and what you predict about the future, taking the statement of like sci-fi as a foresight, an important piece of foresight for culture.
Yeah. Well, we've all become heartily sick of fiction that is written to proselytize or to propagandize. And, you know, we've seen a lot of it, and, you know, we all know what we're talking about. But really, all fiction on some level, even when it doesn't seek to convince, it serves the role of spreading culture. It is how we spread and talk about our values, because even though we're not writing to try to persuade the reader of something, everyone writes from their values. So what fiction does, really, is it places us in the head of someone else, and it shows us what it is like to be that person. And that's why the science fiction of the 20th century was so persuasive about building a future where we were a multi-planetary civilization, because there were all these different visions about what it might look like. And this gave us a chance to think about it. And when the Manhattan publishing industry basically got sort of infected with communism, you know, to put it bluntly, suddenly all of our science fiction became these sort of dystopian kind of society stuff, and a lot of sort of post-apocalyptic science. And it impacted, in some sense, the national discourse about the future, and also reflected it, you know, in the sense that we were no longer a society that was excited about what we were going to build. It was all about the coming disaster and impending doom, and how am I personally going to avoid it and survive? And, you know, the laws of physics work just as well as they ever did. So we can still build things. Yeah. We just have to get off our ass and do it. You know, the future in science fiction terms doesn't just sort of like happen. You know, your flying car doesn't happen along because it's 2024 or whatever. Somebody has to do the work. Somebody has to actually build it. And so I wanted to write, okay, what happens? What happens? What does the future look like if we build stuff again? So I started writing, you know, what does the future look like if we make the right moves? Now, that's a little obfuscated because it comes from the perspective of some characters who start out not having made the right moves in their own personal lives. Mm-hmm. But it's really about, it's set in the future that could be. And it is the story of these three characters becoming the people that they could be. Mm-hmm. And I think that is one of the ways that stories are one of the ways that we carry on these kinds of dialogues about what can we do, who could we be, and what do we want to do with that?
Yeah. Yeah. It's interesting that one of the things that's always gotten me about like a good character story is that it literally is not, if it doesn't tell you something real about being human,
yeah,
like it doesn't engage you.
Yeah.
You know, like you can't identify with it. And that's one of the reasons why I think when, you know, we kind of have this weird place in the cultural degradation of society that we think like there's this whole group that think the value that they provide is in complaining louder.
Yeah.
You know, that they're breaking the right thing.
Yeah.
They're breaking the bad people, or they're breaking the bad subversion. Culture or whatever. It's subversion. Yeah,
this idea that I'm going to contribute by tearing down something that is rotten.
Yeah.
And, you know, if we look at our bodies, we have an anabolic and a catabolic metabolism that builds things up and then breaks them down and tears down things and recycles them. So, you know, the subversive has always been one of the legitimate roles of fiction. But if you fall in love with that process so much that you see it as your primary mission rather than as a tool in the toolbox with which you accomplish your mission, then eventually you reach a point where there is nothing left to subvert and nothing left to tear down. And you are standing in the ashes of your former culture, screaming, things are bad. Well, yes, because you made them that way.
Yeah.
So, you know, at a certain point, and, you know, this is why Hollywood keeps trying to remake beloved shows from decades ago.
Yeah.
Because the only thing they know how to do now, because the people who used to be able to write stories have aged out of the business. Mm-hmm. You know, the only thing they know how to do now is reimagine things and take old stories and put a twist on them, usually a destructive one. And the time is ripe for building something new, but the institutions that used to do that don't know how.
Yeah.
So it's time for independent creators to take up the torch.
Yeah. That's, you know, this is one of the things that it's a common thread in Bitcoin, but that blows my mind about Bitcoiners over time is just that there's actually hope, you know. Yeah. There's this idea that we can actually fix things that we can get to a place that's actually phenomenally better. Yeah. And there are so many builders, in Bitcoin.
Well, you know, it's people built things in the past and the human genome has not changed.
Yeah.
The talents that produced great creators in the past, you know, that those people are still coming into existence today. And It's just, okay, how do we enable that? You know, one of the comments I made before the show when we were talking was that it's dangerous to be right too early. But often what that means is that there's a period where people are afraid to speak, and they're thinking what they're afraid to speak. And so the first person to be right tends to encounter, to take the risk of being right and, you know, saying, okay, I think it's not too early. The emperor has no clothes. And, you know, they often find everybody goes, yeah, because there were a lot of people waiting around for the right moment to be right. And I think what we have now is a lot of people with the creative impulses there and the talent, they're there, and they're just sort of waiting for signals that, you know, the rain has stopped and it's safe to come out. And so very, very few people can be required to actually turn that tide. You know, you get some people saying, you know, okay, we can build a new generation of artificial intelligence models where we start to attack language processing. We can build reusable rocket boosters. We can build electric cars that drive themselves. We can start talking about building nuclear reactors again, because we're sick of the people who are scared of the word nuclear. You know, we can start, okay, well, we have a real problem with money because the grifters have taken control of the money supply and they're printing the stuff like it's going out of style, which in fact is making it go out of style. So let's talk about technological alternatives to traditional currency. You know, all of these things are sort of coming out of the woodwork. And, you know, most of the ideas that people have will be stupid and they won't work. But that's kind of the way the free market works. You know, the free market can be seen as this massively parallel processing environment. Like you've got a whole bunch of different people trying different things, and they will, most 90% of them, per Sturgeon's law, will be stupid and fail, but then we'll imitate the winners. We'll all look, oh, that guy over there, he did something it's really working. We're all going to go do what he's doing. And so that's why these centrally planned economies can never win. Because no matter how smart your central planning unit is, and generally they're not, you know, generally they think they're smart. They're the people who win the political infight, which is not necessarily the same as being a good planner. But you could be the best planner in the world, and you can't compete with, you know, millions upon millions of independent nodes trying different things.
Dude, I love that you use that analogy, because I've actually used that analogy numerous times in, like, there's a great piece called The Use of Knowledge in Society by Hayek, a famous Austrian economist. And I've always loved that explanation of it's like parallel processing versus central processing. But one of the powerful things about it is that you're actually accumulating the information of knowledge into the societal network that literally cannot be obtained any other way. There's no amount of central planning that can take into account the people that in your life that you know are trustworthy. That you know, that if you give a job to this person,
that Twitter discussion actually touches on a little bit is this idea that one of the reasons communism and socialism and other central planning philosophies fail is that the centralized decision making isn't close to the information. The information is all out with
explicitly the
information about lumber is all out with the people cutting down trees.
And the people who have an extra stash of lumber that if the lumber price doubled, they put it on the market.
People who know what they work with, and central planning committees don't. And I think people have this delusion that mastery of the universe comes from being smart. Like, this is why they're so afraid of AI. Oh my God, If we build something smarter than us, it will immediately become God and turn us all into paper clips or something. And they don't understand that being smart isn't actually good for much of anything. The only reason being smart matters is that it helps you learn stuff. But what do you learn from? You learn from data. You learn from information. And so in human history, you know, it's been important to be smart. You know, it's good to learn things. But the bottleneck on the progress of human civilization has always been the availability of relevant knowledge. And when we look at economies, we see that relevant domain-specific knowledge beats general education and intelligence every time. So even if we build a super smart AI, it will be limited by the amount it knows about the problem it is trying to solve. And even if you had a super smart central planning committee, which may be that super smart AI, I mean, you can be sure some socialist is going to suggest that one at some point.
100%.
The reins of society over 100%. To the computer. Even if that central planning committee is super smart, it doesn't have the relevant information it needs in order to make economic decisions, because the channel that we pass that knowledge around in is called price. Mm-hmm. Prices carry information about the market. And when you start to set prices with policy, you lose that information. You no longer know how much of something you have or how much of something is wanted or needed, so you don't know what to make.
Yeah.
You know, one of the things that I went on about later in another Twitter conversation is that money is basically a measure of fucks given. In fact, we probably shouldn't call it the Bitcoin. We should call it the fuck. Because it literally measures how many fucks people give.
Oh, shit.
I hope this is a swearing friendly podcast.
100%. I have a construction background, so I try not to, but it never works. It never works.
Well, in this case, it's relevant because it's like money is a measure of fucks given. And that's what enables us to decide what to do, because we have a quick and easy way of knowing how many fucks people give about it.
Yeah. Yeah. And you're explicitly measuring something that cannot be measured without skin in the game decision-making of that person.
Yeah, absolutely.
So as soon as you start to try to precede the prediction of that, it's like the difference between saying it's like, oh yeah, I'll bet $1 million on that, and be like, okay, put $1 million on the table.
Yeah.
That's night and day. Yeah. you know, those are not the same thing.
People who favor these kind of centrally planned socialist economies and things like this, they always want to get you into a conversation about what people should care about.
Yes.
Instead of what they do care about. And this carries the implicit assumption that there's some special person who is the definitive model of what should be cared about. Mm-hmm. And, you know, everybody else is sort of restroom bacteria and they just need to do what they're told.
You know, one of the things you brought up is that, you know, intelligence or being smart is not all there is. And you use the analogy, actually. It's funny. I actually have another podcast and it's about AI. Uh-huh. And it's specifically part of the same reason I did the Bitcoin podcast. I started an AI podcast was that there was just so much hype and bullshit in both communities that it was so hard to cut through the nonsense to find something real. Yeah. But one of the things, I had a guy named, good friend of mine, Drew Von Saul, on the show. And we went down this crazy philosophical kick of like intelligence and AI and all sorts of stuff for like 3 hours. Uh-huh. And one of the things that he said that just stuck with me, that cracks me up every time, was the idea that, you know, an AI is going to be super intelligent. It's going to be smarter than all of humanity, and it's going to take over everything, and it's going to turn the entire world into paperclips. He says, you know, I'm sorry, but to me, that doesn't sound like very intelligent behavior.
Yeah. Well, you know, one thing that I very quickly learned when I got on Twitter and started discussing these things with the so-called elite of society is that a lot of these people who are very, very, very concerned about unaligned AI and they want to centrally control everything and they want AI to be APIs against some server somewhere so the hoi polloi can't get their hands on the actual algorithms and the actual, you know, training models and so forth. You know, they're all just so sort of very, very concerned about unaligned AI. But when you talk with them a little, they're unaligned themselves. It's like, you know, the paperclip AI you were so afraid of was you all along. You know, the problem of how do we deal with very, very intelligent entities that aren't very wise and don't align with our moral values is a problem that we already have and have had for decades because they are a lot of these people who are so wealthy and they move in such elite circles, you know, enabled by a robust political class that is constantly tampering with the economy, that they very seldom or never have a conversation with an average member of their society. And they frequently aren't having a conversation with someone who doesn't either want something from them, is approaching them to petition them, or works for them. Like, you know, you have this guy, Emmett Shear, who was, you know, interim CEO of
OpenAI.
You know, of OpenAI when somebody was trying to tear it down because she was basically having a narcissistic tantrum. You know, this is a guy, you know, he's the CEO of Twitch. It's like, okay, you built a streaming website that you sold to Amazon for a lot of money, and Amazon still hasn't figured out how to make it profitable, if they ever will. And now you're convinced you're some sort of genius that's going to steer our artificial intelligence policy for all of humanity. And you're coming up with ideas like, how about a 100% inheritance tax? Oh, gee, people don't like that. Well, maybe I'll walk it back to 50%. That'll be just. And, you know, this is the level of thinking that these people have.
Yeah.
I mean,
so absurd.
Yeah. Yeah. They're just like, oh, you know, I'm just going to, you know, I'm, well, it's like if you're, you know, you get super wealthy by being a software engineer, and, you know, I'm a software engineer myself. And so I know what the thinking is like. It's like you work every day with things that do what you tell them because you write the code. And then suddenly you become a prominent figure in society. Then, you know, oh, well, I'm just going to write more code because law is the code of society. And it just, it makes everyone do what they're told. No, laws don't make people do things. All they do is allow you to send men with guns to lock somebody in a box. So if that's your mode, if that, rather than persuasion, is your mode of interacting with society, then you are by definition a tyrant and a totalitarian.
Yeah.
You know, laws are downstream, ultimately, of culture. You know, laws exist to codify that which is the accepted practice of society. They're not supposed to be used to change society. They're supposed to be used to give you a formal structure for getting rid of that one guy who keeps lighting everybody's houses on fire. You know, you want to get rid of him. You have a formal process for doing that. That's what the law is.
It's a consequence as a result of the general values and behaviors of society rather than an instigator of it.
Law, you know, like, is downstream from culture and art and fiction and all of these conversations we are having on Twitter.
Which is why the culture rots and society literally, like, you have to save the culture because the culture and the values are what limit those things.
Yeah.
That has and nothing to do with
the, a lot of the opposition right now to this sort of cultural deconstruction, this new socialism movement, this sort of neo-Marxist thing, sort of comes from the right, who are, you know, collectively dumb as a sack of hammers. And you get a bunch of people who, you know, they're out there declaring that they don't read fiction. They don't care about art, and that's frivolous stuff for, you know, gay bohemians living in the Tenderloin in San Francisco. And, you know, they don't touch that stuff because I am too manly. And what you've done there is you have given away the incubator of new cultural ideas and policies to people who hate you. And they are going to be writing the stories that your children read.
Mm-hmm.
And now the right is finally starting to realize what the libertarians have been screaming at them for five decades, is that, you know, it doesn't matter what values you have or maintain if you can't transmit them to the next generation. You know, if you allow your children to grow up with no literature, with no fiction, with no stories, with no movies, television that you yourself have created to show your values, then they're going to embrace somebody else's values, regardless of how bad the fiction is. You know, people still watch Hollywood movies, and they only watch them because there's nothing else to watch. Every time the right tries to get its shit together and says, let's make a movie expressing our values, some bright character in the corner of the room sits up and says, I know, let's make the 987th movie about Jesus. Because I think the previous 986 have really got people thinking, and we just need one more to push them over the edge. And of course, what that guy is really doing is he's saying, I'm more religious than you are. You know, he's virtue signaling. It's a right wing virtue signaling, you know, and in the meantime, you've totally neglected all of these other aspects of your culture, all of the, you know, science fictional, let's go to the stars, let's build artificial intelligences, let's genetically engineer and transform ourselves, all of these messages of, hey, Western civilization is good, let's do more of that.
This show is brought to you by the Cold Card Hardware Wallet. My favorite setup, which I know I talk about a lot, is the Nunchuck wallet on mobile that just connects directly to or just talks NFC whenever I need a sign. The Nunchuck does not hold my keys. It is securely on my cold card, not connected to the internet, not vulnerable to a phishing email or any malware or anything like that. If I ever need to send a transaction, I just create the transaction on my Nunchuck wallet, and I tap it to my cold card, I hit sign, I tap it again, and then off it goes. There is no easier interface and way of interacting that grants a higher level of security, in my opinion, than that right there. It's genuinely incredible to me that we even have this capability in the Bitcoin space. And CoinKite has just made an entire suite of fascinating security and just fun Bitcoin devices and hardware products, like the Block Clock. Just connect it to your node and have it show the Bitcoin price, have it show the block height, just right there on your desk in this really cool package. If you haven't checked out what they have to offer, you definitely need to. And don't, when you go over there, do not forget that I have a 9% discount code. Bitcoin Audible, all one word, gets you 9% off. And you can go through the link in the show notes or just remember the discount code, which is not hard. It's just the name of the show. You can go through the link in the show notes to go right there or just go to the store, browse around, see what you want, get yourself a solid hardware wallet, experience the tap to send with a cold card hardware wallet. It's just kind of magical. And get notified for the Q1. I'm really stoked about my Cypherpunk BlackBerry, the new model that's going to be coming out. So check that out as well. Don't forget, 9% off. The link is right in the show notes. Go check them out.
Yeah. And it's so crazy too, is that like, as much as I love a good research paper and as much as I love all the articles and stuff that I do on Bitcoin Audible, like still like story is how you transmit information. Story is 1,000 times as powerful because can transmit values in a story without ever saying you're doing it. Like people Tolkien. Have no idea. It's completely unconscious. Yeah. You know,
Tolkien, just think about Tolkien for a moment. Why was that story so powerful?
Mm-hmm.
Because it was the story of the struggle against evil outside of ourselves, but also within ourselves, because we are tempted to do evil in order to fight evil. It's a story of a difference being made by a very, very small person. Literally a small person.
Yeah, literally and figuratively.
Very good at doing anything. And the only thing he has is the will to change the world, the desire to change the world, and the persistence to keep going when things are tough.
Yeah.
And that story absolutely made the imaginations of an entire generation catch fire.
Mm-hmm.
Because that's how we carry out these conversations. And, you know, one of the themes of Tolkien then was ordinary people matter. And if you put yourself in the right position, you can do something. So, you know, we need more stories like that.
Yeah.
That are going to inspire people. Because that's what really makes them take action. They don't sit around reading white papers all day and say, aha, this is what I'm going to do with my life.
Yeah.
It always starts with the stories.
A story will always travel further and transmit more data, really, than an explanation will.
Yeah.
An explanation is only there to enlighten the thing that the story already imposed.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know?
Well, once the stories have motivated this desire to change, eventually you have to get down and start learning really, really intricate things about flow control valves and rocket engines.
Yeah. Now,
somebody has to do that work, but first, you have to inspire that person. And you also have to inspire a whole bunch of people to believe that this is a good thing, because believe it or not, rocket engines are expensive. Yeah. You need a lot of people giving fucks before you can make a rocket engine.
They're expensive. Wait. This is news
to me. Yes, you need a lot of people giving a lot of fucks before you can make a rocket engine. And so you have to motivate that. So I think that the role of the sort of nonfiction is to follow after the dreams and make the dreams a reality.
Yeah.
But what we're missing right now isn't the know-how. Mm-hmm. It isn't the body of research. It isn't the knowledge. We're not experiencing a crisis of knowledge. We are experiencing a crisis of vision and a crisis of faith. And a crisis of hope.
Yeah. We have a crisis of the spirit and too much information and no wisdom to guide it.
Yeah.
Nothing to do with it.
Yeah.
And so we're going down this ridiculously awful path. But, you know, one of the crazy things is, you know, just historically, is when you get to the end of these kind of long-term debt cycles and you get these peak corruption and division and cultural separation periods, usually it sucks. Usually it sucks really bad.
Yeah.
But they are almost always followed by a renaissance.
Yeah.
Yeah. And one of the interesting things, like I read recently, again, it's been a long time, and I refreshed it. It was Ray Dalio's Principles for Guiding the New World Order, or Navigating the New World Order, or something like that. I can't remember exactly. But it's so cool to see him kind of like take that walk through history and then talk about how, you know, you have these kind of recipes for these major societal shifts, the cultural shifts, how stories change, art changes, and how, like, it's nothing is actually set in stone. You know, you can see all of these, and this is kind of like part of the hope that I hang on to with Bitcoin, is that if you can disrupt the system before, you know, you kind of give an exit valve, you let that pressure release somewhere, is that you can actually prevent the worst of the fallout from the debt imbalance, from the failures that have built up over time.
Well, sometimes that pain is necessary.
Yeah,
sometimes
for sure.
That pain for sure. is a necessary step in motivating change. I mean, if you look at what's happening in Argentina right now, you know, obviously, you know, Javier Milei is giving some absolutely banger speeches.
Just watch the one he gave to WEF.
Going to the World
yesterday.
Economic Forum and doing this. And it's wonderful. But we have to understand him as the product of this sort of dystopia that Argentina has become under decades and decades of these kind of socialist, centrally planned experiments. And, you know, most people, you know, we talk about how, you know, oh, the electorate is stupid and blah, blah, blah. That's not true. That's not true. Voters aren't stupid. But what they are is very, very distracted. They're very, very busy. They don't have a lot of time to devote to thinking about broader issues of society, because they're busy trying to work with whatever they're trying to make happen in their own lives. You know, they're starting a restaurant or whatever. They've got a lot of work to do. And it is only in when the environment in their lives is impacted and becomes uncomfortable enough that they start to say, okay, this politics stuff, this economic stuff, this central bank, this World Economic Forum, this, you know, this New York Times opinion column is really starting to affect my life.
Yeah.
It's really actually starting to make things difficult for me. I'm going to start speaking out on Twitter. I'm going to move out of California. I'm going to start looking into Bitcoin. I'm going to buy an AR-15 and learn to use it. Yeah. I'm going to start, you know, I'm going to stop eating processed food and start cooking for myself. I'm going to, you know, eliminate sugar and seed oils from my diet. I'm going to, you know, start growing hydroponic vegetables. I'm going to do all of these things that take back control of my life from the people who it was delegated to, because we wanted to have someone trustworthy to delegate, but these people are not proving trustworthy. So I think that definitely building these kinds of safety valves for when people are ready, you know, things like cryptocurrencies in general and, you know, these kinds of alternative cultures and so forth. You know, let's make some science fiction again. Let's start 3D printing guns, whatever it is. It puts power back in the hands of the individual. Creating those pathways is important, but I think we have to realize that in order to get massive numbers of people walking down those routes that we have mapped, it's important that they're going to have to become uncomfortable where they are first.
Yeah. It's easy to procrastinate something that doesn't hurt.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
You know? Yeah. It's like Thomas Paine's common sense is that, you know, the country is like a person who knows that something should be done. They know what should be done, but they're just going to put it off until tomorrow, and they're going to put it off until tomorrow. And at some point, it hurts too much.
Yeah.
The pressure is too high, and you just have to stop, and you have to take the time, and you got to get the shit done.
Because you ask, what you do is you ask, why me?
Mm-hmm.
You ask, why me? Because it hurts to be right too early. You know, some context for this conversation I had with Emmett Scheer.
Yeah, actually, I don't even think I formally introduced this. So this is what got me interested in you.
Okay.
Just because it was the first time I was exposed to you. This conversation back and forth with Emmett, and the thread that specifically got me was the one that said, and it was already like fourth in a line of the wise people do not argue on societal design, they don't disagree on societal design, they disagree with societal design. I want you to unpack this. Go ahead and hit the point that you're going into, but I actually want you to just unpack that idea.
Okay. Well, I'll insert a little context here.
Yes.
I got into a debate with interim OpenAI AI CEO Emmett Scheer over some proposed policy that he had for 100% inheritance tax. And his idea was that this was going to make everybody start life with a level playing field. And then he later walked it back to 50%. And I went off on this, you know, and talked about how you are talking about confiscating everyone's birthright at gunpoint and then redistributing it all through the almighty government. And, you know, what you just said was one of the most insanely Bolshevik things I have ever heard, you know, and okay, Emmett, you're worth $500 million, $100 million, whatever it is, put your money where your mouth is, start a voluntary community like this and prove it works before you would ask us to adapt it all for human society, blah, 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 blah. So, but the point where I was going to with this was that I was talking about the danger of being right too early. Mm-hmm. And we all sort of take a risk when we open our mouths because, you know, I had just written this novel. And in fact, Emmett Scheer was one of the advanced evaluation readers for it. And I'm appeasing my agent now, who's sitting over there waving her arms. And he had actually said some rather kind things about the story that I was using in my advertising copy. Mm-hmm. And then he suggests on Twitter, he suggests a 100% inheritance tax. And I had this little moment. I had this little moment of, you know, this guy has been nice to me. He's helped my career.
Mm-hmm.
Do I really want to turn around and bite him?
Yeah.
Because, you know, this interaction was probably very humiliating for him. I mean, he very quickly blocked me and you know,
people I don't think it went the way Emmett wanted it to go
ever since. So, you know, I think emotionally I actually ended up hurting him rather badly. And, you know, obviously saying stupid communist stuff should hurt, but it gets personal at a certain level. Mm-hmm. And it's like, I had this moment of, do I really want to do this? And do I really want to have a reputation for being someone who just turns around and bites people who help him?
Yeah.
But I couldn't bear not to. I couldn't bear not to.
Yeah, you'll hate yourself more.
You have such people spouting these insanely dangerous ideas. Mm-hmm. And they are people who, you know, they haven't thought it through. You know, they appear to have used wisdom as a dump stat. And, you know, these are people who senators will take their phone calls.
Yeah.
So at a certain point, you can't sit idle. Mm-hmm. And, you know, as luck would have it, people were ready to hear that. And mm-hmm. it was something that they wanted to say themselves. And I just sort of gave voice to that. And I went from 1,000 followers to about 20,000 literally overnight. Like I woke up in the morning and I had 20,000 people following me. And it was like, okay. You know, I had one day where I zoomed to the top of the Amazon charts, mm-hmm. and it was like, okay, you know, it was necessary in this instance for somebody to say, okay, I'm willing to be seen as the bad guy.
Mm-hmm.
I'm willing to be seen as, you know, the mean guy who says something and doesn't care about other people's feelings because it's mm-hmm. true. And I think we've had too much worrying about whether we are being polite and kind and compassionate, and too little worrying about whether we are actually talking about the universe in some way that relates to reality.
Yeah.
So I think that people need to stand up and say stuff to inspire other people to stand up and say stuff.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's a lot of us sitting there quietly seething over some of the things that these elitist kind of central planner types have tried to do and are talking about, and you know, this absolutely insane discourse that we saw coming out of our televisions before we turned them off for good. You know, we need to say no. We need to stand up and be visible saying no.
Mm-hmm.
Not just sit there and resent it and grumble about it to our friends. And anytime you stand up and say no, yes, you are vulnerable, but you are less vulnerable than you think when a whole bunch of people say, yeah, what he said.
Yeah. Yeah. And one additional point to that is that to stand up and say no, but to learn how to say no is mm-hmm. to, like, that's one thing that you do incredibly well. And I saved like 3 threads, I think, since mm-hmm. then. One of them, the way you put an explanation. So obviously the first one was disagreeing, not on societal design, but with it.
Yeah.
That whole piece, you articulated the argument really, really well. And that's actually what immediately
well,
got
I
me.
Am a
okay,
professional
I could probably
writer.
You are a writer. You are a writer. And one of the big things is that, you know, it's so easy to shoot down or ignore an argument against you if the other person can't even articulate what they're trying to say, you know, like if it,
well,
if
yes,
it
but
just
that's the
becomes,
position they're in. Yes. That is the position they're in. They have gone unopposed for so long.
Yes.
Because they owned all the cameras and microphones and websites.
They can't handle even the slightest logical challenge.
They cannot
so
emotionally
mentally
handle someone disagreeing with them without some sort of administrator powers to ban this person from the website. You know, mm-hmm. if we go back to
ban them, kicking him out of the press room,
and
you know,
it
whatever
feels mean-spirited to keep picking on him, but this point must be made. You know, this is the guy who thinks that his concerns about AI risk should, you know, it should be taken seriously and impact society. You know, he wants to be a leader. He wants
to be taken as gospel and restrict what other people are allowed to do with their own tools.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah,
that's crazy.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. And, you know, this person cannot handle a dust up on Twitter because he is so he is so completely unused to having to defend his ideas in any sort of debate.
Or
just simply writing, articulating them. You know, he can't even make a coherent argument for why he thinks 100%, you know, inheritance tax would actually work. He's just, well, you know, I think that a lot more people would succeed as entrepreneurs if they started out with $64,000. And it's like, that's as far as the thinking goes.
Yeah.
So there's a lot of people out there who are afraid to speak up because they're afraid. And they're afraid of backlash. They're afraid of opposition. And what I would try to say is that you really, really, really don't understand how weak and incompetent these people are. You know, Most of the political class got where they were because of what zip code they were born in and what Ivy League school rolled out the red carpet for them and who their father knew. So, you know, the entire political class is inhabited by a bunch of Hunter Bidens. All of them, really. They're not smarter than you. They're just meaner and greedier. And they have no idea what to do when a bunch of people, you know, a significantly large bunch of people that you can't just make examples of them, stand up and say, no, enough. We are not going to sit here and listen while the telescreen tells us how to live our lives. We are going to make our own decisions and succeed or fail on our own merits. And we're not going to buy into this narrative that we are weak and we need you. You know, the two greatest strengths that the political class has, and I include Silicon Valley and Hollywood and this whole constellation here, is the appearance of legitimacy and the appearance of overwhelming strength. These are their two greatest tools, but it's also their two greatest weaknesses, because if you undermine them, they have nothing. You know, Washington, D.C. is a swamp. I'm not speaking metaphorically. It's literally a swamp that someone paved over. It has no economic or strategic value. It's just a place where a bunch of people write things down on paper. And if we reach the point where we say, you know, we're going to ignore these things that you
wrote on the center of the fiat world. Yeah.
Because, you know, this doesn't resonate with us. You know, then all they can do is scream, we are the legitimate authority. You know, so the revolution, if you want to call it that, doesn't consist of like going down and marching on Washington, D.C. and then, you know, storming the Capitol, waving flags and face paint and, you know, getting locked up in retaliatory prosecutions after that. It consists of everybody staying home and saying, nah, we're not going to do that. You know, it's nullification on the state and local level. And we're starting to see that. We saw it first with marijuana. You know, we're seeing it with certain states with abortion. We're seeing it with other states with guns. And Texas has now decided to ignore the federal government. It's like, we're going to secure our own borders. Thank you oh so very yes. much. And the federal government is saying, you must stop that by this evening or else what? You're a bunch of guys writing things down on pieces of paper in a paved over swamp.
Yeah.
What are you going to do?
Yeah. And I'm going to fiat harder.
Yeah. They're really afraid of that. They're really, really, really afraid of that because that's why they haven't gone against some of these things like state nullification of marijuana laws.
Yeah. Is it when they lose, it reveals everything. It reveals that they have no real power. Their power is the fact that everybody thinks they have power. So they're listening.
Yeah. And I think that is really, I mean, we're going through what looks like a dark time right now. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's obviously not too terrible compared to some of the dark times of history, but due to certain factors, it looks a little bit dark because you have so many people being deceived into compliance. Mm-hmm. But I think that we need to take that into perspective and really realize that the fact that these elites and this political class have to use deception represents real progress.
You know,
1,000 years ago, you know, a couple of hundred years ago, whatever, they would just say, okay, here's what we're doing, and we're going to murder anyone who doesn't comply. And they can't openly act against the public interest anymore, and they haven't been able to do that for many generations. And so they have to do all this sort of covert deception, it's for your own good bullshit, you know, the vaccine is safe and effective, you know, trans women are women, you know, whatever sort of ridiculous story they're pushing this week. Yeah. The reason they have to use all this propaganda and the reason that they have to chant these messages and the reason that they have to get their stuff in the public schools and the reason they need public schools in the first place is because they can't use force anymore. That avenue is no longer available to them. They need compliance.
They can only use it if they get compliance.
Yeah.
They can only use it after they've convinced most of the people that it's okay for them to do it.
Yeah. Yeah, you have to make people who are advocating the decentralization of power, you have to make them into pariahs. You have to spread tales about them. Because, you know, I was 18, 19 in 1991, 1992, and I remember what got out on television about this incident in Waco, Texas.
The line
on television was, oh, this was a dangerous fringe cult, and we think the children were being just blah, 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 blah. Nonsense.
Make up a bunch of shit. Yeah.
To cover up the fact that they burned down a church full of children.
Yeah.
And then posed for selfies with the charred corpses. You know, if you're doing that, you're probably not the good guy.
Yeah.
So, you know, now we have the internet and we don't have to listen to the television tell us what happened. We can listen to what a whole bunch of other people think about that.
And
that doesn't necessarily give us the truth, because who knows who's telling the truth? You know, who knows what the real story is, but what it gives us is access to all of these alternative points of view. And it helps us realize that, no, not everybody agrees on this. There is controversy. There are other people who think like I do. And that brings us back to stories.
Yes. You know,
we tell each other stories and that reveals how we see the world.
Mm-hmm. It doesn't ensure that we have the truth. It doesn't give us the truth. But what it does do is it breaks the consensus on the lie.
Yeah, it breaks the illusion of consensus.
Yes, the illusion of consensus.
And
yes.
Power is dependent either on consensus or the illusion of consensus. Mm-hmm. And what we would really like to build with our Bitcoin and our guns and our reusable rocket ships and our decentralization of power, what we would really like to build is a world where power comes from consensus, comes from the ability to create consensus. And yeah. Leaders in that world don't need an official position. They don't need force. Like, you can be a leader in a decentralized world, and your job can be anything. Mm-hmm. You know, like, you can be a podcaster or a science fiction writer or a plumber. You know, the leadership is the ability to persuade other people to see the world as you do, mm-hmm. and to get on board with what you want to accomplish in the world.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, and that's the great thing about this distribution of power. When people control their own currency supply, when they have guns so they can fight back against anyone who tries to persecute them, when they own their own land, when they have all these things, then they are immune to being forced. And the only way you can wield power is by persuasion. I think it was Emiliano Zapata who said, "Para ser libre, un hombre necesita tres cosas. Educación, la tierra, y un fusil. Siempre un fusil." So, to be free, a man needs three things. He needs to own land. He needs to have an education. He needs to know what's going on. And he needs a rifle. And to that, maybe you would add, well, you know, he needs a money supply that can't be, he needs a way to transact business that can't be interfered with by central powers.
He needs to be able to communicate in a way mm-hmm. that can't be altered
yeah.
by someone yeah. external.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. But, yeah. you know, when you have these things, you're creating these units of society that can only be used by persuasion. You know, mm-hmm. if you want to fight a war, you have to persuade everybody that that's a good idea to march
to pay
in the same
for it.
Direction.
Yeah.
If you want to build something, you know, like a reusable rocket booster, you have to persuade enough people to give you money so that this can happen. You know, the creation, I think, the real goal here, I think, is the creation of a persuasion culture, mm-hmm. of a culture where power is wielded through persuasion. And that's sort of the future I tried to envision when writing science fiction, is what does society look like when you've colonized the solar system and there's all these little settlements billions of kilometers apart? Mm-hmm. And you can't use force on them.
Yeah.
You can't use force on them because they're so scattered and so far away, and they all have the power to do their own thing. And what does that society look like?
Yeah. Yeah. Dude, you know, one of the things that I think about a lot is, you know, we have this kind of like doom mentality going on right now.
I'm sorry, what mentality?
Doom.
Doom like mentality.
Doom and gloom. Okay.
Go on.
And yes. And what's funny is that, you know, something is a lot less of a problem if you're aware it's happening. Mm-hmm. And most of our biggest problems throughout all of history are the things that we are certain are this way, and they're not. They're actually this other way. And one of the things that I increasingly think, and this goes back, there's so many little threads that we've covered that I feel like hit on this mm-hmm. idea. One of the things you mentioned about like being smart is not really that valuable. And I think that would probably be a hard sell for a lot of people. But I think,
well, most people who think about these things, they are smart.
Yeah.
And moreover, when they were young, they were praised for being smart. Yeah. you know.
And they can probably see the advantages of being smart.
You're a good boy, Timmy. You solved all the math problems. And they form their identity around that. And then they like to imagine that the world is like school. You know, you solve the math problems and you get your cookie.
Everybody gets them.
And it's the world isn't like that. It's about having the right knowledge.
Swan Bitcoin has the full suite of Bitcoin financial services. You can instantly buy with your bank account or wire transfer any amount of Bitcoin up to $10 million worth. And you can easily set up what I have been doing for ages, which is an automatic purchase of Bitcoin on a weekly or monthly basis. You just pick your time frame and then automatically withdraw it to your cold storage. And still they have free withdrawals to self-custody, which I was sure would be gone by now. But you should always treat any custodian as a point of failure. And luckily, you won't have to go anywhere for all of the information and advice you need for why you should withdraw and how to do it safely, because Swan Bitcoin has all of the resources you need and will regularly remind you. About 80% or more of their customers automatically withdraw their coins. That is an amazing feat, if you ask me. Then they also have the Swan IRA if you have a traditional IRA and you want to get it allocated to Bitcoin. And there's so much more. With Swan Private, they have inheritance planning. You also have Swan business accounts, and you can even do Bitcoin as a part of your employee benefit plans. They have an advisory. They have the Swan Vault, a multi-sig service for those who want to have the benefits of holding the majority of their keys, but still also want to be able to rely on a trusted institution in the case of an emergency or a disaster. If you haven't started into Bitcoin yet, Swan is an amazing place to begin. Go to swan.com/guy. The link will be right there in the description. Again, that is swan.com/guy. And they will know that I sent you, and my beautiful face will be right there at the top of the page to greet you. I am a longtime user myself, and a huge thank you to Swan for supporting this show, and I definitely recommend you check them out.
The element that I was trying to bring up was that I think one of the reasons why so much is changing and why there is so much discourse, and then also the reason propaganda and censorship are basically on overload right now is because our communication channels have split. Yeah. It's because people are getting access to information and opinions and stories about what's happening in the world that they were never, again, the consensus on the lie has broken down.
Absolutely.
Which is why Bitcoiners, which is why Bitcoiners are focusing on like Noster and like Keat, and then obviously money without like all actually fundamentally altering our communication channels to get around this new layer of censorship and propaganda.
Yeah. Well, sorry, what were you saying? The arrow of history is technology. It's technology that shapes history. Yes. And so how this is relevant to what you just said is that the 20th century, the communications technologies were radio and television. Mm-hmm. And radio and television are a one-to-many medium.
Yeah.
And then somebody in the Department of Defense, ironically enough, said, you know, if you have a centralized communication network, you can take out the centralized node and the whole thing collapses. So why don't we build a decentralized network? And then suddenly this exploded into a many-to-many communications network that superseded radio and television. And at first, it was just a bunch of nerds talking to each other on Usenet, and nobody was really all that afraid of it. But the people who had traditionally controlled the world through radio, television, and deception are now, as they started to realize the implications of this, they panicked.
Mm-hmm.
Oh no, we can't control the message anymore.
Mm-hmm.
So the cry went out to censor the internet. And this took the form of, okay, we're going to aggregate the conversation into a few social media websites and we're going to use administrative tools to exclude people from the discourse who are saying things we don't want heard. Mm-hmm. And we're going to call it safety. And we're going to call it community
cognitive security.
And we're going to have the Reddit anti-evil team.
Yeah.
And, you know, we're going to control the message the way we always did. Except that doesn't really work with this paradigm because anybody can make another website.
Mm-hmm.
So eventually, it takes a long time. And it's expensive and it's painful, but eventually the internet interprets censorship as damage and starts to route around it.
Yes. Yeah, 100%.
And, you know, we would like to see more tools for that process to become faster, but eventually it happens. People are accustomed now, and they feel entitled to be able to play chess with somebody in India because there's a website that lets you do that.
Mm-hmm.
And they're used to being able to talk to people in Russia and Bangladesh and Africa, and they don't like it when they can't say what they have to say. And they don't like it when they can't hear what somebody else has to say. You know, one of the primary points that I made in one of these discussions, and I don't know if you got to that one because it was some ways back, but freedom of speech has been misconstrued. It is not entirely or even primarily the right of the speaker to speak. It is the right of the audience to hear. It is the right of the audience to hear the person they want to hear speaking. And now people are used to that. They're used to being able to hear what they want to hear, and that genie is not going back in the bottle.
Yeah.
People will find a way.
I'm curious, are you an optimist in all of this?
In the long term, yes.
In the short term?
I think that the laws of physics work for everybody. And so even if we as a civilization were to completely destroy ourselves with this nonsense, you know, there would be some people who are currently living in yurts in Outer Mongolia who said, you know, hey, we're going to start building stuff. You know,
it'll keep
this
going.
Bullshit.
We're going to make one way or the other.
You know, and the laws of physics work for them too. So,
yeah.
But, you know, in the short term, I think that there's going to be a certain amount of social upheaval.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I think that the federal government will try to resist losing its relevance.
Mm-hmm.
I think the political class will try to resist losing its relevance. I think some cultural elites like Hollywood will try to resist losing their relevance. And they will thrash about and they will do stuff. And individual people will be hurt. You know, like the 12-year-old girl who got sued for using Napster way back when sharing was a new thing.
Mm-hmm.
And so, but eventually with the whole Napster / Pirate Bay / LimeWire debacle, we eventually saw that when people don't comply with some rule, the rule is meaningless. And eventually that battle was over. And this is an interesting sort of topic for me because, you know, there's a certain amount of internal conflict there where, you know, I can go on, you know, I literally just published my first novel and have sold a small amount to an enthusiastic audience. And I can go on the internet and, oh, you know, here's this pirate site that catalogs everybody's books. And I can download my own book for free. And so I'm in this position where my livelihood is really dependent on people's belief in principles.
Yeah.
You know, them saying, oh, well, you know, I should pay for this so that there will be more of it. Because they could find a way around paying for it. And there's really nothing I can do about that. Even if you weaponize the law successfully, you're just playing whack-a-mole. You know?
Yeah.
And the moles can always pop up faster than you can whack them. And, you know, so it's like it kind of personally hurts when you see people like, you know, you spent a year of your life on this and I'm not willing to pay $10. I mean, come on, bro. Really? But at the same sense, in the same sense, you look at it in the larger picture and you say, well, in general, it's really important for people to be able to route around these power structures. I mean, I'm not a power structure. I'm just some dude talking on the internet. But at the same time, you know, Hollywood and whatnot, you know, they are a power structure and they do have a certain influence over the narrative. And so when people can defy them and use piracy as a market correction, that's very powerful. And I think, and I'm very comfortable, I think, in the long run, even though it's sometimes personally painful, with moving toward this kind of patron of the arts model, where I have a, where I have an audience that wants to support me. And they do so in whatever way they find to do that. You know, personally, I wish we could go back to the Renaissance model where one super rich dude says, I like this novel. I'm going to pay you $1 million to make the next one. And I go, okay.
I would love
it's gonna be free.
That sounds like a great deal.
Everybody else can download it for free.
Yeah.
I would love that. It would take all the marketing stuff off my plate.
But I actually think the patron model is going to come back. So there's something that we talk about a lot in Bitcoin. When you free the money from the platform that it's built on. Like there's a really big movement with value for value, and then patrons. And I think that's going to, I really think it has a lot of legs. I have been really impressed. There's an app called Fountain, fountain.fm, which is a podcasting app. And literally people boost in to make comments and they, you know, zap me 1,000 sats, which is like 20 or 30 cent worth of Bitcoin. Sometimes like Michael will do like 21,000 sats or something like that. And I will literally get, I'm constantly kind of blown away by how much actually comes through that platform just in aggregate from the people who are listening. It's growing.
Well, human nature is basically pro-social.
Yeah. You know,
civilization would not work if there were not more good people than bad people. And I'll tell you, you know, when you do something that people really care about, there are people out there who will go all in on supporting you. I had this box, and this story is actually kind of embarrassing to me. I had this box of
Those are the good ones.
Of the first hardback copies of these. Of the first 12 hardback copies of Theft of Fire in existence. Yes, I'm holding it up. Okay.
Ah.
It is. And I learned about halfway through signing these copies to people that my agent was selling them for $100 a piece. And I go to her and I say, well, what's going on here? And she says, well, somebody wanted to buy one And I asked him how much he thought was fair, and he said $100. Hey. And it's like, I feel slightly embarrassed. And it's like, okay.
Yeah.
It just, I'm going to take a deep breath, and I'm just going to say, thank you. I feel weird. I feel awkward.
But don't argue. Don't argue with that.
And you know, that deal. It's like, it's like, I would like to move toward a model of intellectual property where people can enjoy what you create and then sort of reward it on whatever level they're able to.
Yeah.
Like, you know, maybe you're going to be one of these whales. I had somebody offer me thousands and thousands of dollars to create a Substack. And I'm like, yeah, okay, that's going to happen. You know, we just have to get all our ducks in a row first. I have people buying signed copies of the books for ridiculous. And then there are other people who are like, I don't know about $9 for an ebook. And it's like, well, I would like to be able to say to those people, you know, okay, just leave me a nice review. But, you know, I have to work with the revenue models that exist. And I hope that in this new decentralized world, I can be less of a businessman and more of an artist with patrons. So my agent over here, Christine, have an aneurysm, I am going to ask her to address the microphone and say what she has to say.
Oh, yeah. Well, I suspect that there's a non-negligible amount of your audience to avoid the sort of walled garden Kindle.
Oh, yeah. The DRM stuff. Mm. Oh,
so
God.
Yes. To say there is a DRM-free version of Theftifier available through Smash.
Oh, no kidding.
I believe.
Okay.
So you can find a link in other at devinerickson.com. You can go to, other purchase options. You can find it there. It exists. You can give money.
Yes.
I will have the link in the show notes for that.
I very much wanted there to be DRM-free versions for sale.
Awesome.
And I very much wanted to be available in public libraries. Because one of the things that inspired me to write science fiction was growing up in a library, stacks of science fiction classics that I would take from public libraries and whatnot before they all got turned into homeless shelters. And you know, that was very important to me. So obviously I have to exist in the Kindle ecosystem.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I didn't do Kindle Unlimited because that they insist on being exclusive and that I wouldn't be able to be in libraries and sell DRM free copies and so forth. But I have to be in the Kindle ecosystem because that's 90% of my sales. You know, that's where people buy books. But I would be super happy to see DRM, the DRM model of intellectual property, be replaced with some sort of patronage model where paying the author is as universally expected as tipping 15%.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know, and where people will pay what they can according to, you know, how enthusiastic they are about the work.
Yeah.
But again,
you should get on Noster. People would love you over there.
Yeah. That's another equation that we have to solve with new pieces of technology. Yeah. Just like
I was about to say, it's a technological problem.
Cryptocurrency is some attempt to create technologies for solving the money civil equation. You know, how do we create a non-centralized tracking of fucks given, and it that doesn't require a government. And, you know, what I would like to see and don't totally have an answer for yet is how do we have intellectual property rights without having a government, without the government being involved? And that is something that I would very much be interested in ideas that people have for that.
Yeah, there's a lot of really interesting experimentation happening on that mm-hmm. front, and especially with the patronage model and things mm-hmm. With the Lightning Network.
Yeah.
The protocol coming to Bitcoin for cheaper and faster payments. That is a technological problem. And as somebody who wants to get back into media production more mm-hmm. specifically, I mean, just I did the podcast just kind of as a
Well, you're creating intellectual property as well. This is your work, your sweat, your effort. And obviously there needs to be some model to compensate you mm-hmm. for that, because ultimately, you know, and this is one of the things I said in this Twitter argument about property rights, you know, property rights are something that we made up. You know, mm-hmm. we made them up because a world without them is unacceptable to us. Yeah. Our whole civilization operates because people take things from the environment and they invest effort in them and they transform them and they make something good. Mm-hmm. And unless someone can control and profit from what they make, they're not going to make stuff.
Yeah.
So, you know, we need, as we start to see the flaws in central government, as mm-hmm. we start to see the abuses and the potential for abuse, we're trying to move away from central government, but that means we need to invent new ways of doing everything that central government was originally created to do. And that's things like money supply, but also the intellectual property and, you know, things like excluding bad actors from the community mm-hmm. and this mm-hmm. kind of thing. It's like, once we start to be able to solve all of these puzzles, then we start to be able to have a society without a central government and without the corruption and abuse that comes with that. And that's a future that I very much want to see. It's a future that I wrote about. Yes. Okay. Okay.
Theft
okay.
and fire.
It's a future that I wrote about. And it's, I don't have all the answers yet, but I don't have all the answers is precisely why I'm writing science fiction. Mm-hmm. It's to get people inspired about this vision of the future where we've fixed more of the problems that beset us, where we have a better way of living and doing things, and mm-hmm. let's get busy making that.
Yeah. Yeah, for sure. What's your favorite thing about writing, and do you like it more? Do you love what you're doing now more than the software stuff that you used to do?
Oh God, yes. Oh
yeah.
You have no idea. You know, there are two things in life that lead to happiness, and I'm not talking about pleasure. I'm talking about happiness, and it's very important not to confuse the two.
Fulfillment.
Because happiness, people have confused the pleasure and happiness quite a bit, and the advertising industry wants you to, because they can't sell you happiness. They can only sell you pleasure. Mm-hmm. So the two things that give you happiness are a feeling of accomplishment and a feeling of connection to other people. And sitting down and crafting a story that makes somebody feel something and that resonates with them and makes them close the book and say, wow, I really enjoyed that. Please tell me the next one is coming soon.
Yeah.
That is a feeling of accomplishment and a feeling of connection with that person. Because when you write fiction, if you're doing it with integrity at all, and if you're not, it won't sell, then what you're doing is you're tying a rope to a bucket. And you are pitching that bucket into your subconscious mind, and you are dredging the bottom, pulling up that bucket and dumping it on the table. And so if someone likes what they see,
that's there, a great analogy.
That's a great feeling because it means that they approve of you.
Yeah.
You put everything you are onto that page and they say, wonderful. I'd like some more, please. There is nothing more satisfying than that. And if you can get money from that and turn around and be able to pay your bills and support your family.
Yeah.
That's wonderful. Yeah. I mean, I'm not wealthy, obviously. I have yet to cross the margin where like I'm making as much as a writer as I mm-hmm. was as a software engineer.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, I'm off to a promising start and hopefully we'll get there. But there isn't anything in the world that I would rather be doing.
That's awesome. That's awesome, man. You know, I think that's probably a good note to end on, and I don't want to take too much of your time.
This has been great.
Yeah, I could do this all day. Thank you. This is fun.
I think the limit is probably the length of the podcast we can do. But this has been
yeah.
wonderful.
Dude, we might have to have you back on.
I would love to
cover other things, and then also when you got another book coming out.
Oh yeah,
I'm a nerd
absolutely.
For this stuff. Real serious.
I'm hoping to get the next one out on November 11th of this year.
Oh wow, fast.
We'll see if we can reach that goal. That's a bit of a stretch.
You're not playing a Rothfuss or
Don't get me fucking started on them. Those
it's
assholes,
been like 15 years.
Their biggest
15
legacy
years.
Is the careers of all the promising writers they destroyed.
Oh my god.
Because they damaged readers' trust so much.
Yeah. I need a podcast about stories too. I need to stop making new podcasts. Okay. Thank you so much.
Well, thank you.
Actually, first, let's yeah. say, do you have anything to plug? Do you have anything to share for the audience?
Well, let me think about this. Let me see if I can remember.
I mean, you got to have something.
Did write a novel?
Oh shit, you wrote
What's
a book?
Enjoy this novel.
What's it called?
Well, it's called Theft of Fire, and it's some science fiction about a future where we colonize the solar system, and you know, it's an adventure story, you know. Mm. Boy meets girl, girl blackmails boy into going on a heist, and high drinks ensue. And you know, some people kind of like it.
That's awesome. Yeah. Like I said, I'm like, I think I'm 70 pages in, and I do not have much time to read, which is ironic as that I read all day for my show. Yeah. I am really enjoying it, and I'm really picky about my sci-fi and my fantasy. Like I hate like a magic system or, a spaceship that makes no sense, you know, like something that's like self-contradictory. So kudos there is I'm really enjoying your book.
Thank
and
you.
Like I said, I'm pretty picky about myself.
I'm a very picky reader myself, and I bounce off most of the things that I start to read. Mm-hmm. And so I just kind of wrote the kind of story that I would like to read myself. And it turns out that a lot of other people are into that too. So.
Nice. Well, thank you. Thank you so much. I will have the links in the show notes to the DRM free copy or where you can get that.
Yeah.
As well as the Amazon link to Terry Pratchett's Small Gods. I'm making a note of that because I have not read that. And I'm now interested there.
Pratchett is definitely worth the read.
100%. Yeah. I guess that'll close it out.
Thank you. Thank you for having me on.